Hello, Catherine. How are you?
Hello, Nina. You're back.
Yes, we are both back on our musings about art across time and space.
Uh-huh.
And this time I wanted to share with you my little trip, Compliments of Solari, to New York. Just before it opened, museums, well, the museums have been open for a while, but just before it, the city opened after the pandemic, to the point that there were incredibly long lines in front of all the museums and other attractions. And I just managed to sneak into all these beautiful museums just before it became completely unbearable. By now, it's probably very, very crowded, but it is kind of justifiably crowded because there's a lot of wonderful things to see. So I wanted to share a few of my impressions of having done a pilgrimage to literally 7 museums in 5 days. So this was like hardcore. And I wanted to hear what your recollections are.
And, you know, I just have to point out that some of the museums you went to, a person could spend 2 or 3 days to see everything.
Yes, yes, that's the problem.
So to do 7 in 5 days is quite remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, I would just treat it like going into the office, you go in the morning and you don't come out until the closing. But yeah, the large, wonderful museums have that problem that there are so many treasures that one day is probably not even enough. But I just wanted to talk about some highlights. And therefore, we decided to kind of talk just about a few of them. And the first one I wanted to talk about is MoMA, Museum of Modern Art, that to me is probably the happiest experience of them all, just because for me it's like a candy store in terms of, you know, how many wonderful, memorable, important paintings you can put into a great space that they have built there, under one roof, so to speak. So I don't know when was the last time that you went there. I haven't been there in a very long time. And when I went there, it was just like literally a discovery at an amusement park. It's like, oh, there's this. And oh, there's something else. So that is my recollection of MoMA. And when was the last time you went there?
The last time I was in MoMA was 1989.
Ha. So they probably have kind of rearrange things a little bit. The paintings are old, but, you know, they may have rearranged things. I don't know. I haven't been there since 1990s as well, I admit, with guilt. So it was, for me, a great rediscovery. They do have, for example, a corner, if you like, a few rooms that are devoted to surrealist art. This is the way I like it in museums, when they actually have paintings grouped by theme, at least partially, rather than by the acquisition date or chronologically or by movement or something. Very often the museums, I have no idea how they group their art, because you just walk through rooms and after the fourth room, you just get so overwhelmed that you just stop paying attention to what it is. But MoMA has actually kind of like a surrealist section, I would say. And they have great, great canvases, because they, you know, for example, for Dalí, they have the Persistence of Memory, which is, you know, one of those melting watches paintings.
Ah.
But one of the best ones. You know, obviously he painted many of them, but this is one of the best ones. So it's there. They have Picasso. Obviously, they have 2 major Picassos that are in history of art out of, I don't know, 70,000 works that Picasso has created. There is a canon of, I don't know, maybe 50 that are the most important paintings in the history of art, much less Picasso. And they have the painting that's called The Girl Before a Mirror, which he painted in 1932, which is one of the portraits of Marie-Thérèse Walter, his longtime mistress when he was married to Olga. He was married to Olga until she died, but...
And she was Russian.
She was a Russian ballet dancer, yes, and mother of his first son, and he has married her in 1920s, I think. But by early 1930s, he was kind of done with Olga, so to speak, and she was still Madame Picasso, and she was presiding over a salon and everything, but his solution was just to get himself different apartments and then have various mistresses there. The one that has kind of jump-started his creativity in 1930s was a woman called Marie-Thérèse Walter, who was just like a young blonde girl, very kind of statuesque, young woman who was physical opposite of Olga, who was petite, dark-haired, dark-eyed, uh-huh. kind of ballet dancer, right? And Marie-Thérèse was his muse, who's spurned him to the whole periods of his paintings that are very characteristic. And this Girl Before a Mirror is one of the most celebrated paintings of her, you know, a woman in front of this kind of oval psyche mirror that was popular in France in those days. And it's an exquisite painting that Mama has. Mama obviously has Demoiselle d'Avignon, which is the painting that has kind of moved art from traditional paintings into cubism, modernism, and whatever else you want to say. Mm-hmm. The painting that he was working on for several years and basically has kind of revolutionized 20th century art. So they have that. So they have those two Picassos. They have Matisse still life after Jan Davids, which is kind of like a extremely colorful, beautiful composition, like the best of the best of Matisse. The list of paintings that they have is, they basically have every major artist represented, including Hilma af Klint, you know, the woman painter from Sweden that I wrote an article about because she's so unknown. And there is a painting by her as well. She was an abstract painter before there was an abstract art. You could just walk from one room to the other and just enjoy yourself. And that's only inside. Then if you go outside to the courtyard, it's an art courtyard in which you have the She-Goat by Picasso, you know, this very famous bronze statue of a goat by Picasso. You have a beautiful Alexander Calder's mobile, if you like. It's called Man-Eater with Pendants, which is a large outdoor sculpture. And you can just walk around that beautiful modern space and for hours. Uh-huh. And you know what it is? It's almost like having a textbook of what you can call modern art, you know, end of 19th century, 20th century, 21st. That is a walkable textbook. You can just, if you study art or if you like art, this is like, instead of getting a book or looking at something online, you can just walk around that space and basically everything that is the best of the best you would have seen there. That's my shortest review of that place.
One of the things that's remarkable about the MoMA to me is you're right in the middle of the city. And yet when you're in it, you just feel like in a place of complete calm.
Yeah, there is joy there. There is stimulation there. There is that's what a good museum should be, right? That you just leave everything that is in the street. You walk into that space and you have like epiphanies every 5 minutes because you just look at something. It's like, oh, look how pretty this is. Oh, look at those colors. Oh, I know this painting. I have seen it, you know, on the cover of a book 20 years ago or something. It's just like the constant positive stimulation.
Do they have any David Hockney at the MoMA?
I didn't see it.
Okay.
That is not to say that they don't, but I didn't see it for whatever reason. They should because, for example, they have an exquisite Francis Bacon painting, which is actually called a painting, but it is believed to be a portrait of Neville Chamberlain, the hapless British Prime Minister who was pro-Hitler in 1939, which was probably not the best thing way to go.
Right.
Who was always with his black umbrella. And this is the very dramatic painting of a creature, if you like, that is, there's an umbrella there. So it's considered to be that. It is one of the most dramatic and one of the best Francis Bacon paintings. So what I'm trying to say is that they do have some British artists of the 20th century. Maybe there is a Hockney. I don't know. I didn't see it. They have almost everybody. I mean, you know, Max Ernst and...
Now, I don't remember if you remember, but I went to Figari to see the Dolly Museum 2 years ago, mm-hmm. 3 years ago. And it was amazing because I'd never seen Dolly, you know, from beginning to end, from the beginning of his career to the end of his career, mm-hmm. because there's remarkable change. And according to the locals, we had lunch with somebody who'd grown up, you know, and sort of knew the family, mm-hmm. and who was from that area. And apparently his wife was quite the aggressive marketer. And so, you know, I got the impression she was pushing, the money was basically pushing him to become more and more surreal. And so she was pushing him to become more and more surreal because that's where the money was. Anyway, but it was quite something to see the span from beginning to end, which you rarely see.
Well, any artist that lives several decades, then you see that, you know, Picasso is a perfect example of it, where he went through every possible phase. But going back to Dalí, which is kind of going off on a tangent, first of all, I want to say that there's a couple of kind of semi-biographies of him that are being filmed right now. I don't know at which stage they are. I only read their scripts. But I think by now at least one of them is completed. One of them is going to have Ben Kingsley as Dalí, I think. But the kind of the sad coda to Dalí's life is that towards end of his life, his manager, if you like, and the people who were surrounding him, they figured out the way to monetize his stuff by having prints of his graphics or paintings or whatever printed, and then him signing it. And then towards the end, they were doing even something else, but they were just having him sign empty sheets.
Oh, no.
And then there was a lot of kind of fake Dalís on the market, to the point that, if I can give any advice to anybody who collects, is that to not buy anything Dalí online, because it is probably a forgery. There was this huge scandal about it. Then there was a court case by which time Dalí was not really kind of very much aware of what was going on, and then eventually he died. So there's a lot of murky dealings around Dalí anyway towards the end of his life. But I think you're right about Gala, that at some point that she was much more kind of together than he was commercially, which doesn't surprise me, because very often the artist just creates and somebody else is into marketing, right?
Right.
The best Dalís obviously are in museums like MoMA, because they have been purchased a long time ago and very well researched, and they are probably the best of the best, because the museum tries to have the best of the painter and not just a work by them. So for that catalog of modern art, I think MoMA is unbeatable. So that was my favorite experience.
Now, was that your first experience or?
Yeah, I made a beeline too. No, it wasn't the first time I was there, but I just haven't been there in a long time.
No, the first on this trip. So you made a beeline to MoMA.
On this trip, yeah.
Where'd you go next?
I think that my next stop was the Frick, that I think...
Uptown. So you headed uptown.
Well, geographically, it's different, because probably the Frick that you are thinking of and the one that I was thinking of was this original building that Walter Frick, the actual person, had built purposely as his residence / future museum, right?
Right.
And it's a very famous space that he has been kind of building from like turn of the century and it has been his residence till about 1920, I want to say, something like this. Uh-huh. And then became a museum. But it is being remodeled or renovated or whatever the name is for the next 2 years.
Oh, I had no idea.
Uh-huh. For the next 2 years. They started a couple of years ago, I think. It's whatever it is. But so the Frick is not the Frick.
Really?
Correct. So
I can't imagine the Frick not being at the Frick.
Exactly. But I don't think it's such a bad thing. I'll tell you why. Because what has happened is that the Whitney has moved, and they have abandoned, if you like, the space that used to be the Whitney, which was the Brower Building, which is this kind of brutalist concrete structure in the middle of Manhattan, very kind of gray concrete structure, right, that we know.
Right.
This is now the freak for the next 2 years.
Wow.
And
that's interesting. I can't imagine the Frick in that kind of space. How interesting.
Well, for anybody who has not been to the Frick Museum, that was a mansion of kind of Gilded Age era style. So plush carpet, you know, nice lamps, drapes, nice gilt furniture. This is the surrounding of all the great paintings that Frick has collected throughout his life. So you kind of walk around and you're in somebody's home filled with beautiful paintings against, you know, like an elegant home. That was the Frick experience. But now they took all these wonderful paintings and they are on completely empty gray walls. For me, it's a fantastic experience because all this kind of fussy context of somebody's home has disappeared and all you have is an actual painting on an empty wall.
Right. And the pieces are so captivating.
Well,
they're so amazing that I would think, you know, in some sense, it would be a better background to display them. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying, that even though everybody's used to the Frick as being, you know, this historic mansion, for me, it was a great context because they put it on three floors. One floor is kind of Italian and Dutch paintings, another one is the portraits, another one is the French and English paintings. They kind of grouped together because Frick has collected them more or less within his narrow band of tastes from, like, starting from the Bellini and all the way through the 19th century. For anybody who likes that kind of traditional, beautiful art from, let's say, 15th century through 19th century, European, then you cannot go wrong. There's so many incredible paintings there. But tell me what you like about Frick, because I think this is your...
This is a story, and it's just, I don't know why it made such an impression on me, but it did. So in my 20s, I was in Geneva. I had a friend who I'd met in Afghanistan, who was an attorney in Geneva and on his way to becoming, eventually became mayor of Geneva. He was interested in politics. And I was visiting him in Switzerland and he wanted me to meet somebody who was a family friend, who was an older woman who had a chalet in the Alps. They were there for the weekend. So we went up and had this beautiful weekend in a beautiful small Swiss chalet in the mountains. And I was very struck by the woman. And she said to me, you know, more than anything, I loved the Frick Museum and they have these wonderful books, and they do. You know, you can see it on their website. They have incredible collections of beautiful art books. And she said, you know, when I was at the Frick Museum, I just thought, well, I can't carry all this stuff back and, you know, I shouldn't get it. And ever since then, I've regretted it. And I was scheduled to go to New York right after I got back from the trip. So I said, oh, no problem. I'll just stop by the Frick and get all the books and ship them to you. So she said, oh, well, that would be wonderful. So I thought, okay, well, that's my way of saying thank you for this lovely weekend in the lovely chalet in Switzerland. So I got home and the trip got canceled. Now, I don't know why, but I'm a person, you know, I hate to not keep my word.
Mm.
And it took me a year to get to New York. And the whole time I was feeling so frustrated that I would let her down. You know, because she hadn't gotten those books and had really eaten at her, and I had promised I would do this. So it took me a year to get there. And then, so I got this huge collection of books and, you know, wrapping it up so it wouldn't get torn apart getting to Switzerland. Off I send it. And, you know, so worried that she would think me to be a profligate American who, you know, had taken a year to keep her word. Anyway, so about a couple months later, I get a nice note from my friend who said, you know, that that our hostess was so grateful and it meant so much more that I hadn't sent it right away because that would just be perfunctory. This meant I really cared. And so it was much better that it was late, which proves she's a very kind person anyway. But every time I think of the Frick, I think about sweating it for a year that I wouldn't get the job done. You know, it's sort of a letter to Garcia thing. I don't know if you know that story. And it proceeded to completely brand the Frick Museum into my thoughts and memory. And I just thought it was a fabulous museum. I just loved the whole collection and everything about it. So, and of course, it's right there on 70th and 5th. So I lived right near there, you know, in a couple of the places I lived. So I went by it constantly.
So if you want to visit the original space, you will have to wait till another 2 years. The lady told me that there is no bookstore in that new thing. There is like a counter at which you buy a ticket and you can buy 3 books, which is about as much. So maybe online, but that experience is not there. But in terms of looking at paintings, the paintings are just exquisite. I'm going to write a story about them because there's several of them that the Frick, for example, has 3 Vermeers out of.
How did they get so many Vermeers and Rembrandts?
Well, my understanding is, just to the statistics, Rembrandt is easy to collect, so to speak, even though they have one of the best ones. But in a minute about Rembrandt. Vermeer is only credited with 35 paintings that are recognized to be his. You know, there are some that are questionable, but let's say the canon is 35 canvases. It's very little.
Right.
And the Frick has 3 of them. So this is like an amazing, outside Holland, you know, this is just like an amazing thing. And
right.
Out of those 3, the one that is the most exquisite one is called The Mistress and the Maid. And I love that painting because it features the 2 women. There is a mistress, a lady in a yellow kind of coat and a pearl sitting down. And there's a maid standing over her and showing her presumably a letter, a note, something. We don't really know exactly what is going on. And it is also at night, which is an interesting painting for itself because his paintings usually feature the daytime with that window on the left-hand side that brings in the light and there's a couple of figures inside. Here, this is at night, so you don't see the window. That yellow cloak that the mistress is wearing, we can recognize from some other painting. It features in a painting called The Love Letter, which is at the Rijksmuseum. And the pearl is obviously that famous pearl from The Girl with the Pearl Earring.
Yeah, there it is again.
Yes. So we recognize the prop, so to speak. There is a mystery to it because we don't really know what is the mistress talking about with the maid. Is this some kind of assignation?
But we know it's really grabbed their attention. It's almost like it's, you know, something very important.
Oh, it's a...
There's an intimacy between them that's remarkable.
Yeah, it's a superb painting, whichever way you look at it. There's 2 smaller paintings. Now, that particular painting, I happen to know that Frick has acquired right after the First World War. It was owned by a collector from Berlin who obviously got impoverished after Germany lost the war and there was a lot of reparations and, you know, people were poor. And he had to liquidate his collection. And Frick took advantage of that moment and purchased. That was the last painting that actually he has bought. That painting has a lot of history. So there are 3 Vermeers there. There is this incredible Rembrandt there. It's called The Polish Rider, which is also a kind of a mystery painting. We don't know exactly who is being featured there. The theory is that this is probably someone who is a Polish nobleman, if you like. Rembrandt painted another painting that is called Portrait of a Polish Nobleman, but this one is called Lisowczyk. That was the original title, which is the member of a cavalry, Lisowczyk cavalry. And it was in Polish hands for a very long time. And then one of the...
Thomas Meyer has a copy of this in his home. I love this one.
Yeah, it is a lovely painting. And as I say, it was in Polish royal collection for about 200 years before it got sold. by one of the descendants and ended up in New York. So there are this kind of very, very, very famous paintings that are history of art, if you like.
Right. At the Frick, there's one of Sir Thomas More that I absolutely love. That's another one that they have.
There's two, because actually what they have two paintings next to each other. One is of Thomas More and then of the man who destroyed him, which is Cromwell.
Right.
They're next to each other, kind of looking at each other. He's the man who kind of opposed Henry VIII, and he is the man whom Henry VIII used to destroy him, so to speak. And now they are kind of reunited many hundred years later, literally looking at each other. They're hanging next to each other.
Well, you can tell from the paintings that you'd rather have dinner with Moore.
True, true. But they're kind of reunited, which is very kind of interesting. There's many, almost every single painting that is hanging there has this like incredible history. There's an El Greco, the Christ casting out the moneylenders theme has been painted by El Greco five times over like a period of about 20 years. The first couple of times he painted them when he was still living in Italy. And they're already interesting, but they are still not yet those kind of elongated figures that we know from El Greco's style. And they have like an Italian interiors. They're kind of more traditional, if you like. And then the last three have been painted where he was already living in Spain. They have this characteristic kind of style, you know, the elongated figures. And I think the Frick has the best one. The National Gallery in London thinks that they have the best one, but I have a feeling that the one at the Frick is the best. And you could just stand in front of this painting and look at it and look at it and look at it. And it's the best composition, the best colors. There's this woman in yellow who is in that painting. It's the best El Greco, I would say.
Okay, so you know my game when I go to a museum, I have to decide if I can only take home one, which would it be?
Mm.
So if you could only take home one from the Frick, which would it be?
Well, patriotically, I think I would take the Polish writer and take it back to Poland where it belongs. But I mean, that was the royal collection.
Right, but if you're going to take one to keep at home.
Well,
so let's say you did the Polish writer because you did your patriotic duty. Okay, what would you take home?
Well, I probably would go after the Vermeer, the mistress and the maid.
Yeah, that's what I think. I think you would take the Vermeer. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there is a joke.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, okay, after you left the Frick, where'd you go next?
Well, I went to several museums that I wasn't having such a great fun. I mean, there was fun, but it was less fun. So I'm going to not talk about it for a second. But I did go to the Met, of course, which I think is your favorite. And mine used to be, but wasn't this time. So tell me why you like the Met.
So I can't, you know, because I don't think of the Met as one of my favorite museums, but in New York, if you spend as much time in Central Park as I do,
mm-hmm.
or I did when I lived in New York or when I visit New York, you know, you can't not end up going to the Met. It's so ubiquitous if you're hanging around the park. So, you know, but I've been in the Met, I can't even imagine how many times. And the one thing I've never done is I've never tried to see the whole Met because it's like a mini Louvre, you know, it's just too much.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way, you know, you have to go and see one piece and then leave and come back and go and see another piece. And they're always having huge exhibitions. So the thing I love about the Met is how much, you know, it's packed. There are always so many people going. And they're going not just because they love the art and the museum, but because it's part of the park. You know, it's a great place to have lunch. It's a great place to meet people on the stairs. You know, the Met is like a world. It's the only way I can describe it.
Hmm.
And it's also a huge business because they do, you know, their shop is sort of one of the great, you know, sort of gift shops of New York City. So the Met is literally, it's a whole little city in a city. It's the only way I can describe it. One of my favorite things about the Met is the Cloisters, which is not at the Met. It's up much further north at the Cloisters. but I don't know if you've ever been there, but just...
No, I went. I told you.
Oh, you did?
Everywhere.
Okay. So...
I went to the cloisters, and I agree. The cloisters is a great experience because it's, unlike the main one, it's not so huge. It's like an experience of being in a monastery in a way.
Yeah.
But if you haven't been there in a while, I mean, the Met, then they have hung a lot of things, reorganized things for various reasons. And the one thing that they did is that the thing that I like is that they put one theme together. There's a little nook corner, if you like, where they called it the Dutch Republic's art, I think they called it, or something like this. And they put all the great Dutch...
Oh, wonderful.
...masters together. I don't know if this is the permanent reorganization, but I think it is. That's where they have their Vermeers together. And they have several ones, including the one that is kind of like a young girl who is looking at you. She turns away, I mean, turns towards the viewer, if you like. So it is extremely satisfying experience to see all the Dutch paintings together.
How many paintings in the collection?
I would say that altogether is about, I don't know, 50 canvases. Not all of them, of course. You know, some of them are very well known, like Vermeers or Rembrandts, but some of them are just landscape painters or... most of them are very well-known painters, but they are kind of grouped together, which is, in a way, the way it should be able to see, because it comes from the same culture and the same world,
mm-hmm.
and the same kind of spirit, if you like. So it is good to see all the Dutch paintings of that period together, because then you learn something. So I like that grouping very much.
They have them all on the... You can go to their website. They have all the Dutch... They have something called Dutch Masterpieces at the Met, and you can see all of them.
Yeah, that's that corner, if you like. And then there's another mini gallery that is called the New British Galleries, where they have done a similar and smart thing, meaning they grouped, you know, various British artifacts from the period of, let's say, like from East India Company period, so 17th century. 16th, late 16th, 17th century through the 19th century. You know, all the teapots together and all the crystal together, whatever. The material goods that have created or kind of describe the might of the British Empire, if you like.
Wow.
It's a very interesting mini gallery, if you like.
Uh-huh.
And that's something that is new at the Met and worth appreciating. And you're absolutely right that otherwise you just go there and you're completely overwhelmed because there's no way to visit it all in one day or two even.
Right. You have to just pick one or two things out and really just do those.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a museum where you can have a great lunch and take a break. You can do something, you know, 2 hours and then have a great lunch and then do another hour or two.
Actually, my post-pandemic discovery is that none of these museums you can have a good lunch because every single one of them, great art and extremely horrible cafeterias or restaurants because of whatever.
Really?
Yeah, they just give you some horrible sandwiches wrapped in paper. There is no good food there.
Oh, it's over.
Yeah, I'm not a foodie at all. I don't care. But even for me, this is the food that you wouldn't feed to a dog. So...
Huh, that's too bad.
If I think that this food is bad, they're just sandwiches.
Well, you know, one of the great lunches of my life was having lunch with you at the Museum d'Orsay in Paris.
Oh, no, not that kind of experience right now at New York. I'm sure it will change, but right now, if you want good food, don't eat it at the museums. They just have some horrible sandwiches.
Well, but you could never have as nice a lunch as we had in the Museum d'Orsay, so I'm not trying to say that it used to be that way. Now, if you wanted to have a great lunch, you used to go across the street to the Stanhope Hotel, but that's gone too. So, yeah.
Exactly. Most of the museums are barely reopening now in New York, so...
Which goes to prove that Andrew Cuomo cannot destroy everything. Right?
Yeah, probably. I don't know. I'm not a New Yorker, so I'm.
No, he's trying. He's trying.
I've no dog in that race.
Well, I was there. I had some friends who were going to see the Wagner's Ring at the Metropolitan Opera, and I stopped in New York on my way to Thailand in the spring of 2019 and spent, several days in the park. I went to the Met, everything, and it was just, it was glorious New York Central Park. And it was like a farewell to a world that I used to live in and love, and now it's gone.
To a certain extent, yes, because I mean, life is resilient and will come back. But right now, New York, when I was there, the shows were still not on. Most of the hotels were closed. Most of the restaurants were only serving outside, or they were completely shuttered. So, and there were no tourists. There were no domestic tourists because, if there are no hotels and there are no shows, then why go, right? And international tourists do not travel. So there were just locals, and even the locals were kind of subdued. So from the point of view of a museum goer, this was great because, the museums were not so overcrowded. But
Right.
the New York experience that most of us have in mind, kind of the vibrant New York scene was not there. Everything was just kind of subdued. But it doesn't mean that it's not gonna revive a couple of weeks later after my trip. So that would be recent. Apparently, there were like thousands of people trying to get into museums in lines in front of the Met or something.
Oh, I can imagine. I can just imagine.
So, yeah, so it's coming back, I think. But it is an interesting experience, I would say. You're probably right that in 2019, if you went there and it was glorious and kind of vibrant, that was kind of a farewell to a certain world that is still not back, if ever. So we'll see how that plays out.
Okay, where'd you go next?
No, I think we've run out of time, so we can't go, at least in this episode. But I think the moral of all this thing is that the museums are still there in New York. The glorious art is still there. These are perfect places to, for anybody who loves art, to just kind of recharge batteries and look at the masterpieces. Because if there's one thing in New York museums, is that of any painter, they will have the best of the best.
So I just have to say two things, though. We cannot close a discussion of great museums in New York without mentioning that everybody should see the scene in the International where they have a gunfight in the Guggenheim Museum. This is the best way, in my opinion, to really see the Guggenheim Museum.
Wait, what are you talking about? Which scene in the National?
The scene in the International where they have a gunfight in the Guggenheim Museum.
What are you talking about?
The movie, The International.
Oh, the movie.
The movie, I'm bringing in the other thing you write about of Food for the Soul. The movie, The International, has a gunfight in the Guggenheim Museum,
Yes, it does.
which
Yes.
is a great way to see the Guggenheim Museum if you can't go to New York. That's number one. But number two, what I just want to say is that you have written some great new columns based on your new museum trolling and adventures at Food for the Soul. If you come into Soleri, you can just click on the logo for Food for the Soul and go over to your website. And there's some great new columns, and there's some great new columns in the most recent wrap-up and coming up in the new wrap-up. You've been writing about coins, and now you're going to be writing about paper currency. So I just want to remind everybody that your column publishes twice a month and it's fantastic. And in addition, then there are four in the four wrap-ups. So there's two every month and then four in the wrap-ups. And I think for movies or putting people onto great museum and art experience, there's nothing better. And I point that out to you because all of these other periodicals have been stealing all your stuff. And it irritates you, but it makes me very proud.
Okay, well, that's a completely different different podcast, I would say, completely different conversation. But yes, I wrote a story about one of the exhibitions at the Whitney, but it's really, we are out of time on this one, so it will have to be the next one.
Okay.
But thank you so much for your recollections of the New York museum scene that doesn't exist anymore. There's a new one, but museums are still great. So, and yes.
Yeah, they are. They're great museums. Everybody should see them. They're fabulous.
True, true.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Catherine. And till the next one.
Thank you, Nina. Have a great day.
You too. Bye.